It's Golden Hour Adventure Time, featuring everyday people doing extraordinary things. From the peaks of victory to the valleys of defeat, these are their stories. Now, from the back of the pack, your hosts, Justin and Robbie.
Welcome to Golden Hour Adventures. I'm solo today. Justin's got a work assignment, so you get to listen to me and the guest. Today's guest is Kenny Hill. He's a podcaster. His podcast is called Patinaed. Welcome to the show, Kenny.
Thanks, Robbie. Yeah, glad to be here, man. I've been looking forward to this for, I don't know, I've been on the calendar for about 2 months, so I've been looking forward to this this interview. Yes, pretty cool.
Yeah, you reached out to us on Instagram and said, why not? Come on. We're always down to listen to someone's story. And we were chatting a little before we started, and I didn't, you know, Kenny reached out to us and I didn't know much about Kenny, but we chatted a little bit before. So I think this is going to be a fun one. We have some things in common. Kenny is an ultra runner, so we do have a runner today, but there's a lot more to Kenny. So why don't you tell us about your podcast?
Yeah, of course. Ultra, even just like being called a runner or an ultra runner is still kind of new to me. So it's still like I'm absorbing that identity a little bit still. But I guess we could talk about that a little bit as we get going through the story. But yeah, the podcast is called the Patinaed Podcast. So patina and then with a D at the end. So that's on YouTube, on Spotify, and now on Apple Podcasts as well. And the whole podcast is revolving around the theme of resilience. And that's something where for me, I consider myself to be a student of resiliency and my own sort of life journey, which I guess we'll probably get into here. It's all been about this experience of this slow, progressive journey of building up resilience and getting to the point to where you're doing something. And at the time you're doing it, you reflect back and you're like, well, that previous version of myself would never be able to do this current version of myself type stuff, and just kind of continuing to build that up. And so I'm interested in other people's stories and how they do that. You know, for me, I come from a background of sports growing up, being okay at sports growing up, but then going into the military, being a combat veteran, infantry soldier in the army, and then being an addict, and then getting into recovery, and using some of these tenets now of resiliency building. I didn't know what I was doing then, but trying to become a more resilient person so that I didn't fall back and relapse and go back to the substances. And then eventually getting into, you know, sponsoring people, and then eventually getting into becoming a therapist and running my own private practice and helping people with trauma and addiction and all this sort of stuff. So I have my own journey where it's kind of resiliency one step at a time has continued to build up and build up and build up. And, you know, before I know it, I'm doing something absurd, and I'm doing something where one of the mantras I speak with my clients about is chasing failure. And I live that, and I'm just like, okay, so I'm going to get into this way of living now where I'm actually chasing failure, which is this thing I would have done everything, scratched and clawed to stay away from in the previous version of myself. And so me just kind of reflecting back and seeing what the blessing of suffering and what the blessing of resilience has given me in my life, then I'd love to hear that in other people's stories too. That's one of the things when you go to a 12-step meeting and meetings that are similar, you hear a lot of that. You hear this resiliency built up, and it draws people in. They're drawn into the grime and the muck and the nastiness of somebody's story, but also they're drawn into hearing how they got out of that. And so I wanted to take that and that theme and branch out from beyond just sobriety or recovery oriented themes, and then take that into just all aspects of mental health, physical health, spiritual health, all these different aspects where somebody can become more resilient in areas, all the different domains and things that they can do to become more resilient. So it's been a fun journey. It's a very early journey with the podcast. Prior to that, I did something called Story Of, which is like a little mini doc series. And I'm not like a tech guy. I'm not a filmmaker. I'm like I'm just a grunt that is interested in other people's stories and trying to help them. And so, when I was getting sober 17 years ago, there was like the show Intervention, which I think it's still out. I don't know. But back then, like I'd be high and I'd just be listening or watching the show. I think it was on A&E or I think that's what it was. And I'd be watching the show Intervention and they would like, you know, show an intervention and it would be dramatic and the family would show up and point their fingers at the person and be like, you suck and shame on you and get help. And the person would lower their head in shame and go and get help. And some people want it and some people would. And, but they never talked about like at the end of the episode, they'd say, this person is, you know, this person's been sober for 6 months, but they want to say how the person got sober or the tools or the methods in which they stayed sober for 6 months. And so I would be watching this back in the day, you know, up for maybe 48 hours or more and watching the show and be thinking, well, if my family ever did this to me, this would be my escape plan. This is how I would get out of there, you know? So years later, I'm thinking about that. And I think there's much more content on how to specifically, oh, your dog is mooning us in the back. That's hilarious. just gave us a show. Yeah, it's awesome. But yeah, so the, you know, like I think now there's more specific advice and specific things on what you can find for free on the internet. And, but nonetheless, I wanted to create like a little, show that's like, and it's called Story Of, so you can go and look up Story Of, Story Of podcast, I think, but Story Of, and it's under the Recovery Hill, channel and, on YouTube. But essentially what I wanted to do was to create something that somebody who is like me 17 years ago, that for me, it was scouring TV, but they might be scouring YouTube. And then all of a sudden they stumble upon some video with somebody in recovery who has sustained recovery and they're talking about their story. But more importantly, they're talking about specific advice. Like here's some things that I did to help me stay sober. This specific thing worked, this specific therapy worked, this exercise worked, or, you know, this type of thing. And maybe I used this tool to help me get more comfortable with taking on that type of adventure. All the kind of nitty gritty of how somebody could get sober and stay sober, I wanted to include that in that. And so that kind of started this whole, you know, going online thing. Before this, like, haven't had Facebook and 10 years or something. And I wasn't on Instagram. I wasn't doing any of this stuff. I was just kind of doing life and raising my four boys and trying to be the best dad and husband I can be and running a private practice. And then I, you know, had this, you know, this attitude of servanthood and wanting to hopefully reach somebody randomly. And even if it's, you know, even if the video gets five views, if one of those views helps somebody get in, change their life, then that would be it for me. That would, you know, that's the die on my pillow, a happy man type story, you know? And so, anyway, so that kind of led into this next thing. As I'm doing that and editing those videos, I was getting burned out editing those Story Of videos. Like doing the interviews was fantastic, but editing the videos and trying to make them look as good as possible, making sure that I'm giving everything I can to the video, trying to make it look as professional as possible for somebody who's completely unqualified in that area, took a lot out of me. And so it began, my thought as I was doing these interviews was like, man, I'd like to just do a podcast, a little back and forth, you know, and that would be a lot less editing. It wouldn't take me 25 hours to edit a single episode, you know. So that caught me thinking about it. And then the actual title came up for me before like the whole, you know, I guess the whole outline of the show came up for me, that the title of the show came out for me and came up for me, which is Patinaed Podcast. And so I was out doing a long training run one day and, you're a runner too, Robbie. So you probably know random thoughts come up and they feel, and random thoughts, tethered to, adrenaline can feel really, really good. And like, this is like a great idea. And some of them are good and some of them are not. But so I was out on this long training run and I was just thinking randomly, like, what is it about like antiques that people really enjoy? Like, why is it for me when I think about antique or things that are made to look vintage, those things are two clearly different things. Like something could be made, you know, a lamp or something could be made to look old and antiqued, but it doesn't have the same feel as if you stumble into a garage sale and there's some really cool old rusty lamp and you're like, that thing is awesome. It still works even better. Like I was just going to use it as an ornament, but it works awesome, you know? And so it got me kind of thinking, why are we more drawn to things that are old and worn down and rusty versus things that are new, work with far more efficiency, but they're not just not as cool. They maybe have an appearance, but you can tell right out, like that's not really old. That's new and made to look old. And for me, in my own personal experience, I think it's the same reason why we look up to the elderly. That, you know, like if you've ever gotten to share words with a World War I vet, I know there's not many around anymore, but even a World War II vet, and now even more a Vietnam vet, if you've ever gotten to share words with these people, or maybe it doesn't need to be a veteran at all. It could be somebody that worked in a shoe factory for 60 years and you just share stories with them, or you hear their story, you let them share their story. It's incredible. I can't hear anything else. It's as if I got noise canceling headphones on and there's nothing else coming in. I am so focused and wanting to absorb every little word, every little nook and cranny of their experience. And why, I think, well, naturally as human beings, like that's the importance of the elderly, is to drop, impart wisdom. And it's not just wisdom that you get from a book. That stuff's cool and great. But for me personally, earned wisdom is everything. Like wisdom that's earned through experience. That's it. That's everything. You know, like Robbie, I can talk to you about the ins and the outs of sobriety, but you're going to take me more seriously. Just the fact that I've been sober 17 years. Like even if I was sober 6 months, you would take me far more seriously than somebody who is a normie that's coming at it from book knowledge. And that's not to degrade people who are normies, because there's a lot of normies out there who are experts in the field of addiction. Dr. Drew Pinsky is one of them. I take his wisdom very seriously on it. But, you know, anyway, so getting back to the Patina podcast, I feel like it was just kind of coming up for me where I'm like, okay, there's something about the beauty of scars, the beauty of old rusty dings. I got this old International Scout that has this dings on it, these old rusted spots on it, and it's got this patina on it. And there's no way you couldn't pay me to go and put that into a shop and get a new paint job on it, get the rust scraped off of it, and to make that thing look pretty and shiny. You couldn't pay me to do that. There's no way I would want to do that to that thing. It would dishonor the years of life that it's had, you know, and my own weird romantic sense of this whole experience. But so patina kind of came up for me as just being this experience that this is what you're doing when you're chasing failure. This is what you're doing when you're taking on resiliency, is you're becoming patinaed as a person. It doesn't have to just be through going and running far or just going through and doing things from a physical exercise standpoint. It could be going back to school, even though you're incredibly frightened of it, or the time is not right for you. Or it could be something as small as having that hard conversation with somebody that you once did wrong and you've been avoiding it forever, right? Like it's these little acts of doing things that we know we ought to do, but would prefer not to do. And so for me, again, that's where patinaed comes from. So I had this idea of patinaed, and I got it on. I made my own little running, shirt from Etsy and got patinaed on it. You know, I'm like, okay, that's the run I'm going to do my next big run on or whatever with it. And that led me into doing this thing called Fund Run for One, FUND Run for One, Fund Run for One, where I was raising money for one person to be able to get into high quality, expensive residential treatment, who otherwise could never afford it because they're essentially homeless and don't have insurance. And county is a 6 month to a year long wait list. But so as I was doing this fun to run for one, which was the very beginning of my running experience, before that I wasn't running at all. But as I was doing that, I got this patinaed, uniform and was all excited about it. I was like, okay, this is what I'm doing. Like, this is the very heart of patinaed, is I'm going to go out here with terrible knees and feel every single, mile of this run, but I'm going to do it with a greater purpose and a greater cause and that sort of stuff. But yeah, so anyway, that's the theme of the patinaed podcast, is talking with people about their experience, their patina, their earned wisdom, and really getting into, and also, like, I guess, trying to extrapolate how they did it. You know, what was the unique way? And I think as you listen to several episodes, you begin to get a theme. There's different words, but the theme seems to be the same of what people are saying, which is really cool. But anyway, so that's the patinaed podcast. I think I don't know. I think maybe I have 6 episodes out right now. I got 2 in the bank right now recorded that I'm working on the editing with to put it out. The last episode was with Mark Munoz, the retired UFC fighter. And so that was a really fun episode. And yeah, I've had episodes with, highly, highly resilient people, incredible people. Meet them in the shopping market and in the stores, something, and you wouldn't know them from Adam. You wouldn't know their story. But once you start to open up and hear their story, you're like, holy cow, this person is like, they're incredible. Their experience is incredible. Their authenticity of how they got to their experience is incredible. So, yeah.
I like that. You know, I'm a car guy too. And I love the patina look. And like you're saying, like, that takes years, mm-hmm. and it's weather worn. And, you know, talking about resilience, for me, that's what has made me become who I've become, is all those years of really, I'm not gonna be able to say the word again, resilience. Everyone has a story, like you're saying. Just if you're in the store, you don't know any of those people, you don't know their story. They could have a horrible story or they could have a wonderful story, but we're all people in the end. And I think a lot of time as a society these days, we forget about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that saying, you don't know until you walk through someone's shoes is a, you know, pretty, pretty big thing. Just to have empathy for other people, to show empathy. Mm-hmm. It's really a lost thing in our society. So what has resilience brought to you from ultra running?
So we'll have to step back to the first run I did. Perfect. Before it was technically an ultra, but it was the hardest run I've ever done. I wasn't, you know, I was, I'm a combat veteran. So when I got out of the military, I was like, okay, my days of ever exercising are over. I'm done. Like, I'm never going to exercise again. My knees hurt. I'm done. And then I went on the meth diet. And so I got out meth and alcohol. So I was drinking a fifth of alcohol and doing a lot of meth. For the alcohol a night and doing a lot of meth. But, and so when I got sober, I just didn't know how. I had a child's version of what to eat, of what a diet would look like. I didn't know how to eat. I would just be like, okay, I'm going to eat this Little Caesar's large pizza because it's $5 and I'm just going to eat this large pizza to myself. That's what I'm going to do. So when I went into rehab, I was 130 pounds. When I got out, a few years later, approximately about 3 years later, I was about 250 pounds. And so I'd gained a significant amount of weight. And like, my biggest focus was, when I got sober, was just staying sober, you know. And then it transitioned. I began to transition from everything that the rooms had given me foundationally, the rooms of 12 steps, and what they had given me foundationally. And I began to transition into like, okay, what does that look like spiritually? And I began to really invest into my spiritual life. And then I think I was maybe, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years sober before I actually started re-implementing exercise into my life. And I might be off on my timeline, but somewhere in there, before I started implementing exercise in my life, I was not exercising. And I had all the great excuses. I have terrible knees. I got a bad hip. I got bad lower back. I got all these great excuses. And so I'll kind of speed it along for the sake of your episode. Long story short, I began to start exercising again because a doctor really put me into a corner and just kept me accountable, wouldn't take my excuses when I gave her all the excuses. And so I started exercising slowly, like just walking in place while watching Kings games. I'd watch Sacramento Kings games and walk in place for 15 minutes a quarter. And that's that. And then I'd start implementing some push-ups and some exercises that you learn in high school and then body weight squats and different stuff. And then my physical exercise journey took off because I was so overweight that I saw improvement relatively quickly, you know, like I was obese. So it didn't take too long for the weight to come off and for me to see a positive reward. And I just kind of kept going, and my wife got pregnant. It's like, okay, well, I want to be around for my son, and I don't want to be the type of dad that can't play catch with his son. I want to be able to play catch with him, and you know, all that sort of stuff. And so I started taking my physical health more seriously and just being consistent in it. Fast forward, I don't know, several years later, still not running. Like, I'd run very periodically. I would do something like go and see what my mile looks like or something and go and run it and then be gassed and be done and be like, okay, now I'm going to do box jumps or something instead of running because I'm not down with running. I just am not a runner. I'll do other things for cardiovascular thing. I'll do like HIIT training or something, but I'm not going to do running. And then one day like I said, I have a private practice. I'm a clinician. I work with people who are in addiction and people who have trauma. And I was consulting on a case with another therapist where we had the same person together. And I was consulting on the case, and she had mentioned, her name's Ricky Townsend, incredible woman, incredible person in the world of recovery. The things that she's done for the last 20 plus years for people in recovery is incredible. But so anyway, she's, I'm sorry, I think 40 plus years, but she had kind of as a side note, had mentioned how she walked a marathon to raise money for a person to get into treatment. And I was immediately like, as she was talking, I couldn't really focus on what she was saying because I was filled with anger and frustration. I was like, I'm in the back of my head and I'm being kind to her. I'm not like yelling at her. I'm being, okay, all right, well, I'll talk to you later. Thanks, Ricky. Thanks for, you know, that sort of thing. And then I get off the phone and I'm filled with like just assessing myself. What is going, like, why are you so mad? What's your deal? I'm like, I'm jealous. And I'm mad that she did something that I'll never be able to do. I'll never be able to do a marathon. That's ridiculous. And I had this thought then come up where it was like, well, you know, like if you train for it, you could do it. So, you know, anybody who trained for it properly can do a marathon. So don't worry about it. You're okay. And it was this real placating thought. It wasn't like this nice, like it wasn't a sturdy foundational, like thought of positive reinforcement or anything. It was like this placating, nauseous, like somebody coming behind and kind of massaging your shoulders and be like, you're okay, buddy. Like it was so frustrating to me, this thought coming up. I'm like, okay. And so I'm in my head this whole time. And I'm like, okay, so like, fine, you just do a marathon without training for it, you know? And then I laughed audibly this whole time I'm in my head, but then I laughed audibly out loud. And then I was followed with the audible laugh, like this sickening, like pain in my stomach. And I kind of doubled over and grabbed my knees. I'm like having this cramping in my stomach, like the somatic reaction toward what I just said. Well, you can run, you just run it without training for it. You know, you're such a hotshot, just run it without training for it. And then I realized what this pain was the fact that I'm now accountable for that thought. And I think now I have to do it. Because if I don't do it, I'm going to go into the state of avoidance and I am going to tear myself apart for it. It's going to take a lot more work to avoid it than it will take to actually run it, is what I'm saying. And that's saying a lot. And what we now know with resiliency is it's essentially a contagion, like, because there's an intermix neurobiologically in your brain that happens. And when you avoid something, it becomes a contagious behavior for the next 48 hours. And if you can, so for the next 48 hours, you're like, it's far more easy to continue to avoid things than to try to do something hard. Anyway, so me knowing that, I'm like, crap, like, dang it. Like, now I don't know. I think I have to do this. And so I'm just processing it. And then I go in the house and I ask my wife, or I more kind of tell her, I'm like, hey, I had this weird thought. She's like, what? I'm like, I think I got to run a marathon. She's like, what? It's like, no. Like, I think I got to run it without training for it. She's like, no, that's stupid. Like, no, no, you're not going to do that. I'm like, I don't know. Like, it's funny because when you say that, it sounds even more like I need to do it. Like, there's, for some reason, intrinsically, it even feels even more firm that I need to do this. And so then I call, one of the things that I do in these situations is I don't just go off of my own sort of thoughts. I have people, accountability sources that I reach out to and kind of just bounce it off. And I texted another buddy, sent him a text about it. And his exact response was, oh, that sounds stupid. I'm like, okay. So, but even more so, I feel like I need to do this. So yeah, dang it. And so like, I was hoping he was going to offer me some good spiritual wisdom and, you know, something like, no, you know, like something really good that I could help me not do this and not feel bad about not doing it. But it's stupid wasn't the answer. So anyway, so I began kind of processing this. I reached out to a buddy of mine named Aaron Terberg, who's a very talented videographer and filmmaker. And so I reached out to him. I'm like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this thing and I feel like it's worth videotaping, or I think it's worth getting documentation of it. Would you mind doing it? He's like, yeah, but like, that sounds awesome. That sounds like something I'd like to do, but you know, I'm months out. So, I'm like, dang it. I think it was, I'm going off memory here, which is not a very, which is not the most accurate thing for me, but I think it was like a month and a half out, if I remember right. Anyway, so now I'm stuck with this thought of I'm going to do a marathon without training for it. And I'm a month and a half out and I still can't train for it. Like, I'm purposely keeping my regimen the same. I'm purposely keeping my workout regimen the same. I'm lifting weights, I'm doing yoga, but I'm not running at all. And so I have this month and a half period of not running and knowing that this adventure is in front of me. And the whole thing is I can't do it without train, or I can't do it and train for it. So that made it somewhat even harder because I badly wanted to start getting my body in some type of condition for it, so it would be less painful. Anyway, so we go out there that day, and what I had was Aaron was out there on his bike recording it. And then I had my stepdad go out there with me. It was on this Folsom Lake trail out here. And it's something like, I think a little over 12 miles is the loop. So the first loop, my stepdad did it with me. And the whole story's crazy. Like, he got into a huge bike accident on that first loop where it almost ended it. It was like, okay, I guess we're done. I almost ran, I literally ran across the path and almost ran over a rattlesnake that was in the path. All this crazy stuff was happening. So I finished the first loop and I'm crapping super bad. And as long as I've ever ran, the longest I ever ran before that, I think was maybe 7 miles. If I'm being very generous. So I've already finished the first loop. My body's breaking down. I'm cramping like crazy. I have no idea what I'm doing. I brought very little water out because I didn't know. I didn't know. I thought it was way enough water, but I just didn't know. I didn't bring out any electrolytes because I didn't know. I just, again, I'm not a runner. I didn't know any of this stuff. So I lift weights and do yoga. That's it. And so anyway, so I get to the second loop and then my buddy Jason comes out and he does the second loop with me. And as we take off, so it's a second loop and then some, right, to get to the 26.2. But, and then, so we take off and I just apologize to him right at the beginning. I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. Like, this loop is going to take a long time. Like, this is bad. Like, because I'm already cramping. I'm not even halfway done yet. Like, this is going to be bad. So we take off and I get about to mile 15 and then my body just stops. It shuts down. I started getting cramping so bad in my calves. I reached down to go and put like a compression. Like, I have these compression pads for my elbows. I don't have them for my legs again, cause I'm not a runner, but I'm like, okay, well maybe I can bring those in case I cramp or something. So I brought them and I bent down to put them on and my whole body from my neck, from under my ears to all the way through my spine, through my lower back, through my hamstrings, through like my Achilles tendon, my like toes bent. And I just locked up, my whole body stretched out and locked up and I laid on the ground for about 15 minutes. and it was just one of the most painful experiences, I've ever had. And I've had a few very painful experiences and that was one of the tops. And so, I'm laying there for about 15 minutes. I go to get back up and my body does it again. Some nice lady running on the trail. This is probably one of my first experience with the kindness of runners. Because she just stops and hands a goo gel. I didn't even know what it was. I just take it. I'm like, okay. Oh, that tastes awful. Okay, let's go. So I get up and the whole rest of the experience was just this, like the mental challenge of it. And the songs that are coming on in the headphones, that like Tom Petty's Breakdown is coming on in my headphones. It's like, Breakdown, go ahead and give it to you. I'm like, screw you, Tom Petty. And then I was also when Cameron Haynes' book just came out. So it was just released. So I'm like, this is perfect. I'll download it. This is going to keep me all motivated during the run. This is how recent this was, right? And so I'm listening to it and Cameron Haynes' like big advice on there is like, just go out there and do it. You can do it. And if you're going to do a marathon, make sure you train for it. I'm like, bro, Cameron Haynes, like, dude, you're hard. Like you're supposed to be this dude, like that I'm looking up to go and do crazy things. And like, you're telling me I should have trained for this. And now I'm out here doing this thing and I haven't trained for it. So anyway, I get to this point to where I'm walking and then, you know, I'm doing little bits of jogs, but I'm not walking like I'm hobbling because like my hamstrings are locked up. And so I'm like walking with two stiff legs as if I don't have knees. So I'm kind of from time to time kind of picking up my pace and we ran out of water. My buddy Aaron had to go run off several times and grab us water and orange juice and whatever was at the local, you know, Shell station or something. So I get to the end of it and it's this moment of like, I cannot believe that just happened. I did something that I truly thought I was going to fail at. Like this meet my quota of chasing failure more than anything I've ever done. Like this meet it. Like this was something I was going to come out here today, go and try really hard, get 12 miles in, and then my body wasn't going to let me do it. And I was going to keep pushing and I was going to wake up with a paramedic in my face. That's what I thought was going to happen. But my body kept going and it kept going. And even through severe dehydration, it kept going, it kept going. And so I got to the finish line and, you know, seeing my family at the finish line was the dream scenario. It was the movie end of a movie scenario, right? And in fact, Aaron put out the video, and it's on my Recovery Hill YouTube page. It's called Chasing Failure. And so the whole video is out there and it just documents the thing. But like, I was thrown off because I'm like, you hear, you know, like you hear people, ultra folks, and like, I'm a big fan of the ultra community before I ever got into it, because of the resiliency that they, and the wisdom that they have to share with it. Sometimes you hear someone and you're like, wow, have they gone to school for, you know, to get their PhD in psychology? Like, like they have great things to share. But so you hear people say like, you think you know you're capable of something until you do something that you thought full well that you weren't capable of doing it, and then you did it. And this was that experience. So everything I had done up until that point of, at that time, 15 years of sobriety, didn't it paled in comparison to that one experience. It was just like, holy cow. So everything up until that point was maybe like, there were a few things where there's some big leaps, but for the most part, the resiliency was this slow pattern of consistency over prolonged periods of time. And again, in between there are a few things like starting my private practice and, you know, sort of stuff where there is like a leap from having no experience to all of a sudden having experience. Like it would be like a version of parenthood, you know, and some version of it from a resiliency standpoint. So anyway, this was that, like, this was the biggest leap of going from having no experience to fully thinking I was going to fail to completing it. And it blew my mind. And it was just like you hear with other ultra runners where they're on ultra sign up the next day. The next day I'm sitting there and I couldn't walk. Like I couldn't, the next day I'm sitting there and essentially all day I'm sitting there with my feet up, sprawled out, being like going to the bathroom was the biggest chore ever, you know? So I'm sitting there and I'm looking at like running ideas and different things. And that's when I came up with this idea of Fund Run for One, where I'm like, okay, so what's the next thing that I can do? How can I raise money for someone to get into residential treatment? That otherwise would never have it, that I don't know who they are. I don't have any ties to them, but they'll come, you know, and sort of thing. But anyway, so, and then that led into, you know, the next run was, well, I can't do less than a marathon. What's the next mileage? Oh, a 50K is the next mileage, I guess, is what people are saying here online. So I got to do a 50K. And how can I make that more miserable? Let me do it around a track, you know? And so so then I decided, okay, I'm going to do a 50K around a track. And then the journeys just kept going from there. And that journey started about 2 years ago. So yeah. And then I ran, I went from a 50K to... 12 hour run. And that one blew me up, the 12 hour run one, cause it was in winter time and I think I had mild hypothermia, and that one was awesome. Like I wanted to get 50 miles and I ended up getting 55 miles. So that was like, whoa, what am I doing? Like, this is crazy. And then it went into like 100 kilometer, the Cool Moon, out in Auburn. And then, I did a 100 miler, I don't know, probably about 4 months ago, 4 or 5 months ago, something like that. But, that's been the ultra journey so far.
Which 12 hour did you do?
What was it called? The, winter solstice or something like that. Tiny little run around like a bike loop, a mile bike loop. So just loop after loop after loop.
Yeah. So like you like getting loopy.
Yeah, I do. A little bit too much, which is why I can't do it anymore.
Yeah. What was your 100K?
It was called the Cool Moon.
The Cool Moon
in Auburn. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was that on trails?
That one's out there in the, you know, the famous Auburn trails out there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that one was a crazy deal of resilience too, because it, yeah, I mean, I don't want to take up the whole episode just talking about how I was in pain the whole time, but yeah, but that was a good one. That one was harder than the 100 miler, the 100K.
Oh, ones. Really?
Yeah.
What, yeah, which 100 sure. did you do?
It's called the, Ride to Walk.
Okay.
And yeah, out in Roseville, California. I got to do that one with Ed Ettinghausen and Ray Sanchez, which is pretty cool. The Jester and Ray Sanchez. So that was cool.
My my first 100 miler I ran with Ed for maybe the first 10 miles of it.
Yeah.
And my first ultra was 2011 and my first 100 was 2014. And I didn't know who Ed was. And all of a sudden I come running up to this guy wearing a Jester outfit. And I was like, I got to hang back with this guy. And then after you talk with the guy, oh my gosh, that guy's got story after story. And
yeah,
you know, the stuff he's done is bonkers. It's
yeah. So after this, Robbie, I'll send you the link to the, he was my third episode. My third episode was with Ed.
Oh, really?
For Patina podcast. Yeah. And so he goes into, it's a great episode. He goes into a lot of detail of his past and his upbringing, and just kind of his, you know, his unbelievable plethora of records that he has, like most ever of this, most ever of that, most ever of this. And then now as he's turning 62, he's wanting to run 62 100 mile races in that year. So that he'll break the current record of most 100s but also kind of do it to match his age. So yeah, the man is an incredible human being. Yeah.
Then Ray Sanchez, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. So he's another one who's just ran, I think he's done 15 now, bad waters in a row. He's about to do a 16th this year. And, he does, yeah, he's a wild man, but, he was a professional boxer before he ever got into running. And, I actually met him at the, 100K at the Cool Moon. He was just being of service, volunteering at one of the aid stations, and met him, got his number. And so he kind of helped me prepare for the 100 miler, with just phone calls and all that. The weekend or like the Friday before, I call up Ray. I'm like, hey, so any last minute advice for this run tomorrow? And he's like, oh yeah, yeah. You know, kind of talking with me about it. And then he's like, so which one are you running? Which one are you running again? I'm like, the Ride to Walk. And he's like, oh, okay. Oh, that's the one I'm doing tomorrow. I figured I'm signed up for that one. I'll see you tomorrow. I'm like, so you're just going to rant like just on a whim, go run 100 miles? He's like, yeah, I feel like I want to get in some miles. He says, I want to get in some miles. And he wins the thing. He wins it. Wow. Yeah. I'm like, this guy shows up to get into miles and wins it on a torn meniscus. So yeah.
Just another training run for him.
Yeah. Guy's amazing.
So you started, your first self-supported marathon was, what'd you say, 2 years ago?
Yeah, that was about maybe a little over 2 years now, but yeah, okay. It was 2 years ago. Yeah.
So you went from 7 miles to marathon, 50K, and then just took off.
Yeah. The last time I had run 7 miles was years prior to that. And I went out it was one of those Forrest Gump moments. My dad had died and I just went out for a run. I think I might've accumulated about 7 miles in that. It wasn't like being logged, but it was one of those things where I kind of drove it afterwards. I'm like, I think I might've been about 7 miles. but yeah. So yeah, I can't express it enough. Not a runner, just not a runner.
No, you are.
Yeah. 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 And I think like it's incredible because my excuse for the longest time was my knees. And don't get me wrong, for the first 6 months of just going from no running to running for distance, my knees were in a lot of pain. Like now where my knees are like, there's a twinge here and there. Like if I go out on a long rucksack or something, a long ruck, and I have, 45 pounds on my back and I did pretty good elevation or something and went at a good pace, my left knee will feel it a little bit, but it's more like now I got my Achilles tendons are, that's like the actual, I'm like, please don't snap. Please don't snap. Please don't snap. But yeah.
I was listening to a podcast with Dakota Meyer. Do you know who Dakota Meyer is?
Yeah. I'm aware of him. Yeah.
You know, he had some issues after his whole, stint in Afghanistan when he got back, and you know, he was talking about how broken he was from being, you know, being in combat, and he kind of, you know, had some issues after he got back, started drinking and all that. And he talked about, he started running, and I was just like, it's so interesting to me that, you know, people think they're broken. And this goes back to the resilience thing too. People think they're broken or feel broken, doesn't matter. And then they just start doing something and they realize that they can do it. And it does actually help. I mean, I'm sure you've been told, or like, that's just going to ruin your knees from running all those miles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people seem to forget if you don't use it, you lose it.
And yeah, I was told by doctors to avoid that type of stuff. Like walking is fine, but avoid, because I was overweight and I complained about my knees. So they said, avoid like running and stuff. And for me at that time, I was like, that's perfect advice, 'cause I don't want to run, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're helping me out here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any, are you training now for any races, or do you have anything coming up?
I don't have anything that I've signed up for. I have one that I'm looking at, which is actually Ray Sanchez's. It's his event. It's called the Folsom 100. So I'm looking at that as something. What I wanted to do this year was, I did the California International Marathon in December. And then I wanted to, after that, really focus on, because I had read somewhere that rucking will help alleviate the way the ruck carries on your back. It alleviates the stress, how you carry the weight. It alleviates the stress on the Achilles tendon. So I was like, okay, well, let me see if that will help my Achilles work, as both of them can get pretty flared up after a long run. So I've been rucking a lot. So my training regimen has been like 2 days of rucking and then 1 day of running or like slow jogging. I'm so slow. That's one of the things I really like about your guys' intro, the back of the pack. Because I may not be the back of the pack, but I'm so slow. I might as well be. It just happens that the races I've done are so small that maybe I'm not the back of the pack, to answer your question, I've been, there's no race officially done yet, but I'm seeing how these Achilles come along, and if we get there, I think it's in May, I believe, and if we get there, if we arrive in May and it's May, if we arrive there in May and the Achilles are feeling good, then I'm going to go ahead and buy it and do that one.
That's awesome. You know, a lot of the ultra world's kind of crazy with, especially with social media these days, of, you know, you got to go run and do all this other stuff. But a lot of people forget in these longer distances how much we really walk. And
yeah,
depending on the course, you know, if there's a lot of elevation gain, you're not going to be running.
So
it just gets a little mixed up, where I think rucking is a perfect thing because you got that weight on you and you're going at a slower pace, you know, you're staying in zone 2, maybe zone 3 sometimes if you're pushing a little bit, but that can just be so beneficial for people to slow down a little bit. And it really helps with, you know, overuse injuries.
Yeah. So I did the race I just did. So I did the Jed Smith out here in Sacramento, and it's just on a bike path, but it's like, 50 miler. It's been around for like 80 years or something, apparently, but has it been 80? I don't know. I can't remember what they said, but anyway, so it's been around forever, this run, and it's 50 miles to to, I think, I forget the different elements, but one of them was a half marathon. And so I signed up for that because I wanted to see if I could unofficially qualify for the Army Ranger Ruck test. You know, it's like 12 miles and you got to do it under 3 hours and it's at least 35 pounds of dry weight. So weight not including water or food or anything like that. So that was I went out there and I did that one. I just posted the video, the reel on that about it on Instagram today. But so yeah, I went out and did that one, and kind of one of my fears with it was like just being weird and being out there with a rucksack and while everybody's running it, just like being strange. Cause there's no, like in Northern California, there's very little rucking events. So I signed up for an ultra and I wanted to, you know, beat this time. So anyway, I went out and I did that, and like I'm midway through it, I'm like, oh, I forgot. I underestimated the ultra community again. Like these people, they're just the most accepting community. They like didn't bat an eye at the fact that I'm out there with a ruck, you know, and people show up there with jester outfits, right? Like, and no one bats an eye.
You're right.
So, yeah.
When I was at Bandera this year, they have so the 100K, they have a 24-hour cutoff. Then they have like this ruck division, which I didn't know about till the day of. Excuse me. When I was out there, there was maybe 6 or 7 people rucking it. And I was like, man, that is so cool because, you know, right from the get-go, they're just walking.
Yeah.
They're just walking and going as fast as they can. And I was like, that's got to be an experience to just chill. I mean, they didn't have rucksacks on. They all just had pretty big backpacks on.
Mm-hmm.
They were just out there walking through the hills of Texas for 24 hours or whatever they took to finish. I was just like, that's really cool when a race will allow that. A lot of people, depending on the permitting and stuff like that, you know, some of these cutoffs don't allow everyone to get into those races anymore.
Mm.
But 24 hours for 100K, you can essentially walk that 62 miles if you want, with whatever you want. I just like, and you're right. I don't, you know, I do hear about a lot of the rucks that go on, you know, through the nation, but you're right. There isn't too many of them, but maybe something that should bring back.
Yeah, there's something like SoCal. There's some and like the, yeah, but there's where I'm at. There's I can't find any. So yeah, like my big thing with that one is I wanted to. There's a time I wanted to get it under 3 hours, and so I just did a little trot the whole time, just like a little lean forward and kind of trotting my feet, and that's one of the things when I met Ed, you know, like I think maybe we did 7 miles together, something like that. But I'm short, man. I have little stubby legs, and he like for me. So for him, where he's walking, like I'm like trotting, you know, I'm like I'm trotting. And so it's the same type of trot that I was doing with the ruck, where I'm just like, for other people, this might be a walk, but for me, I have to trot. Otherwise I'm not going anywhere. My legs are too short.
Yeah. I totally get that. Yeah, I didn't realize. I mean, it's pretty tall compared to me, and I guess you. When I came up on him, I was like, this guy in his jester's outfit's a little bigger than I thought.
Yeah, he's big, man.
Yeah,
yeah.
So you said you've been in recovery for 17 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. What made you decide to choose that?
Choose recovery. So I was 24 when I got sober. I was 24 when I got it. Let me take a drink of water real quick. I was 24 when I got sober. When I got out of the military, I was given a lot of money. For me, what was a lot of money to get out, essentially, because it was a medical honorable discharge. So I got out and I had 15 grand in the bank. And before I joined the military, I was already an addict. You know, before I went in, I was already, a heavy, heavy drinker, and I was, doing meth. I was like, I don't know if there's dabbling in meth, but like I was using meth, often, or I was using meth often enough. And then I used meth to get into the military, actually, which is probably not the best story, but yeah, like, I needed to drop some weight, to get into the military. And so, meth, helped me with that. And then, yeah. And I got into the military. And so when I got out, I had PTSD, from combat and a traumatic brain injury, which I didn't realize I had that for, several years, that went undiagnosed for several years. And so like when you're asking me about, or when I'm talking about dates or times or like numbers, the reason why I can't remember that stuff still is, traumatic brain injury apparently. But, yeah, I got out, and when I was in the military, I was drinking heavily. I would use, like uppers here and there. When we were in garrison, or when we were back at our station, and I'd cross the border going to Canada, pick up something, come back. I was stationed in Fort Drum, New York. When I got out, I had this money, and, I couldn't wait to use drugs without potentially getting in trouble or losing my job, you know? And so I went into that, and it just, it went really quickly. I remember telling, a buddy of mine, hey, Ryan, like, if it seems like I'm doing this all the time, like, let me know. Like, if it seems like there's a concern. The person I asked was a guy that I was using with, which was like, he was using just as much, if not more than me. So he's like, what? Like, come on, I'm going to keep you accountable. Like, you're my using buddy. Come on, dude. So that happened. So I was using heavily. And then like my behavior was weird. I got really, really thin. And I would just blame any weird behavior on PTSD and kind of look at people with, you know, like a how dare you face if I felt like they were questioning my behavior or something, you know, because how dare you? Because the reason why I'm acting this way is because I went to combat. So, you know, shame on you sort of thing, like really pull that card. And let's see. One of the jobs, I was working two jobs. I was working one job to pay the bills and one job to pay for drugs and alcohol. And so I was working two full-time jobs. And one of the jobs that I worked for was landscaping. It was with my dad's company. And one of the branches of his company was landscaping. And so one of the job sites that we would go and do landscaping at was at his house. So every Friday we'd go to his house, and I'd plan it so that we'd go and like do his yard and stuff like right around lunchtime. And then I'd take lunch, go into his house to use the bathroom. That was quotation marks, use the bathroom, and then go in there and smoke some meth, and then leave. And so, though I was very particular about making sure that like I was not going to lose my stuff. I thought I had my stuff together so that I wouldn't get caught with it. One day when I left out of his bathroom, apparently my stuff, my rig, all, you know, or whatever, my little, pouch and the stuff that I had in it, and my pipe and all the stuff that I had in it was, fell out of my back pocket. And I didn't know I had on this, like I went on with my day and stuff, and I couldn't find it when I got home. I would go home midday. I would sleep for about 3 hours, wake up, and then go to my nighttime security job. And so I woke up like 3 hours later to go to my nighttime security job, and I couldn't find my stuff, and I was freaking out. And so, I'm like, where did I leave it? I call my buddy Ryan, like, hey, can you come over, bro? Like, can I borrow a little bit off of you? I'll get you back. I'll get you a whole eight. Like, I'll get you a whole eight ball if you just like let me get some, you know, like, because I need to go to work and I can't find my stuff. So anyway, he couldn't come to my apartment. He met me at my job site. I was a security guard at night. And so he came out to the job site, you know, gave me some. And then I gave him like a bunch of money, like way over, paid him for it, for his troubles. But he asked me, like, what do you think is going on? I'm like, I hope this isn't true, but I'm thinking maybe I might've dropped it at my dad's house. I don't know. I hope it didn't happen. And this was right around Thanksgiving. And so, he's like, well, what are you going to do if he confronts you? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, what would you do? I'm like, I don't know, man, but I think I'm done with this. I just feel like I'm done. Like, I don't know what that means, but I don't want to deal with this obsessive component where I'm constantly wrapping my time and my life, like including having a whole job to keep this behavior going. You know, like I was done with that side of things. I was done in that moment when he asked me, because I just had used some meth. Right. And I was like, so there was parts of me where like, I knew I was done, but there was no real plan. There was no, like, I'm going to actually stop. It's just this idea of, I would like to be done with this whole cycle of things. And so like weeks go by and there's nothing. And I kind of feel like there's like maybe this intervention, like we talked about at the beginning of this episode, like maybe there's an intervention coming or something. But nothing happened. And so, my dad and my brother helped me with moving some stuff into my apartment, and my brother left and my dad stayed put. And I began to feel like, oh crap, man, like what's happening? And then my dad comes in, he's like, hey, I want to talk to you for a second, son. I'm like, okay. And I'm going to work through this to not get emotional. So he says, he approached me like an adult and like a man, and probably better than I deserved to be approached at that time. And he says, I know there's something going on. I know you're doing drugs. Are you doing drugs? And a shocking answer came out of my mouth. It was almost as if I could hear myself say it and couldn't believe it came out of my mouth. I said, yes. And then he said, okay, well, I can't have you working for me and driving our vehicles and stuff while you're doing that. But so what I can do is try to help you get help. Do you want help? And again, I was shocked by the word that came out of my mouth, which was yes. And as if, again, audibly, I heard myself say it, but it was almost like almost an out of body experience. And he said, okay. And he got my stepmom involved, Robin. He got both of them got involved and got me connected with the VA. And I went to the VA and I started going there, to get treated for this stuff, PTSD or whatever was going on. And I wasn't sure exactly what was going on. I knew I had gotten out with the diagnosis of PTSD, but like, I didn't really know what was going on psychologically. I hadn't had real treatment. And so I began getting treatment for that. I joined a group there, a dual diagnosis group for combat veterans with addiction. And it was me and like three other guys. It was like it was such a small group. And is this story taking too much time?
No.
Okay. So I was there. I was there at the VA and we're at this group, and I'd been there probably 3 weeks or so. And there's a new facilitator, a new therapist that came and started facilitating it. His name was Leif Carlson. He later on became my mentor and was he was a huge part of this whole beginning journey for me. And he had said, we'd go around the circle, just kind of, you know, check in, how was your week? What were your challenges, that kind of stuff. And so we go around the circle and it's my turn to talk. And everybody had talked before me and they talked about sobriety and how it's doing great for them and all this sorts of stuff. And I look at everybody in the circle. I'm like, what are you guys even talking about? What does sobriety even mean? You keep using this word sober or sobriety. What does that even mean? I don't even know what you mean by that. Here's what I know. I can get about 2 or 3 days without using meth. And then I'm going to go and use meth, and I can't stop myself from not doing that. No matter what I do, I cannot stop myself from doing it. And guess what? Today's day 3. And right after this meeting, there's nothing you can do other than put me in jail or something to stop me from going and getting more meth. And then, and by the way, as a side note, I was still drinking every day at this time. I was still drinking a fifth of alcohol a night at this time. So, but I just couldn't get away from the meth, and I thought the meth was my only problem. And so, I pointed at the facilitator, Leaf. I pointed at him and I said, and guess what? I got about 6 months to live and I'm going to die. And it's your fault because you guys have a 6 month waiting list for me to go and get residential treatment. Well, guess what? I'm ready to go now. And you guys have me on a waiting list. And if I die, it's your fault. And I was pointing at Leaf because he represented the VA for me. And so, I don't remember much of that. I remember, like, as I was saying this, I was crying because I was so defeated and I was genuinely trying. I just couldn't do it. And at this point I had, like, both jobs were gone, you know? So I'm like, I'm working anyway. Maybe I'm going about getting my drugs in ways that I would prefer not to get them. And so, the meeting had ended and I'm leaving the meeting and Leaf pulls me aside and he says, "Hey, so you're really ready to go now?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "If I could pull some strings and get you in as early as this weekend," this was a, I think this was a Thursday. It might've been a Tuesday, but he said, "If I can get you in as early as this weekend, will you go?" And I said, "Yes." And I got a call again from him, the next day, I believe, if my memory is correct. And it was Leaf. And he said, "Hey, we got you a bed. You're going to go to this program. Are you still going to go?" I said, "Yes." And so I showed up. That was January 29th of 2007. And I went into rehab with the full intention of never wanting to use meth again, but thinking that alcohol wasn't my problem. And then I realized that my problem was actually intoxication in general. And so if there was a substance that's going to get me intoxicated, then I'm going to abuse it. And it was one of those things where, for me, rehab was needed because it was the experience of not only getting away from the scene and kind of putting myself in a place where I can't just access it out of a moment of weakness, but also having conversations. I was so fortunate because I went to the most low-budge rehab ever. It was like I was in there with a bunch of guys that there's this this bill that was just passed saying that if you're there on 3 strikes, then you can get out as long as you go to a rehab program. And so I was there with a bunch of prisoners, essentially guys that just got out. And it was fantastic because everybody there wanted their life to change. No one was there because mommy and daddy made them. No one was there because their wife was threatening divorce. Everybody was there because they wanted to be sober and they wanted to change their life. And so it might've been the most low budget program ever, but it was the milieu. It was the experience of everybody being on the same page. And I happened to be in there with a guy we called Preacher Man, who he had 20 plus years, I think 20 years of sobriety from alcoholism. And I think he had stopped programming. His daughter committed suicide and left him partly to blame in the suicide note. And what else do you do at that time? Right? Like, he had the greatest excuse in the world to pick up a drink or a pistol, you know, and he chose a drink. And so, he relapsed, obviously. And then, you know, talk about timing and God's providence. But, so I'm in rehab with a guy who's the best therapist there, but he's a person there. He's just, he's a person there trying to get sober like me, but he's the best therapist there. The other therapists there were like, you know, they're the most beginning level of therapist that you can get, right? Like they're not credentialed. They're like just the very beginning of level of therapist that you can possibly be. So they're not really offering the greatest support other than packets of paper, but having Preacher Man there, was game changing. And he's the one who got me to think beyond just meth being my problem, but it actually being an issue with an addiction to anything that's going to get me intoxicated. So yeah, that's the very short-winded story. It wasn't short-winded at all, but yeah, that's it.
No. Thanks for being vulnerable and telling that story. You know, one thing I've learned through recovery is everyone's rock bottom is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate what, you know, the media and some other groups tell you what rock bottom is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't take, you know, losing a wife, losing a kid, all the stuff that they glorify as us as addicts, mm-hmm. as rock bottom. It, you know, you already kind of had that, you know, in your head that you wanted to stop. You know, if you didn't leave your stuff in the bathroom, who knows where you'd be now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I just don't want it to be, you know, glorified as, you know, getting drunk, then getting in a car crash and killing someone, or mm-hmm. your fifth DUI. Like, for a lot of us in recovery, we make that choice to stop our substance abuse for whatever reason it is.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's other people that do actually have that rock bottom where that is the case, where they, you know, they go kill someone by accident because of alcohol or whatever substance. But it's always good to hear someone else's story that you kind of made that decision
mm-hmm.
before, that you knew something was wrong and you needed to stop. So I just want to thank you again for telling your story.
So I think that point is so big, Robbie, that you just brought up. So it's one of the biggest excuses that I have to deal with clients that are, you know, like, okay, they're running a business. They haven't had a DUI. They've gotten lucky hundreds of times driving drunk, but no DUI yet. You know, because they run their own business, they're successful financially. But the person that they love the most, and the person which is like their spouse, let's say, is just so sick of it. And they're on, maybe they haven't threatened they're going to leave and leave them, but they're like, I can't stand the man or the woman you've become. I can't stand it. I can't. And like, and so if the disappointment of the person you love the most in the world, like, is your, and your excuse is you still haven't met bottom, well, then you're fooling yourself. You're fooling yourself because you're catering to the myth that you need to kill somebody or you need to put gutter water in your veins before you hit the bottom. And I think for me, my bottom like was around this time period. I remember looking at the mirror with my shirt off and I was just disgusted with myself. I was like, I hate you. I hate you. I was so upset with myself. Like, not just because I was like skinny and like all sunken in, but because just looking at myself and being like, I don't even like physically, I can't recognize you. Physically, you are like, I hate you. I hate you. You've betrayed us, you know? And so, yeah, I think that's a, there's a lot of myths, Robbie, that are said, and that's one of the bigger ones. And it keeps people's addictions alive because it's so perpetuated. It's said over and over and over. You know, you have, the other myth is you have to want it for yourself. That one has killed a lot of people. You know, you can only get sober if you want it for yourself. That I know more people who got sober because of consequences, because they were forced to get sober, than people, than people who just chose to do it. And years and years of sobriety, years and years and years of sobriety. And it's either because, you know, court appointed, or because their parents made them, or because their wife made them, or whatever. But then eventually the motivation turns from extrinsic, which is, I don't want this consequence. And then it turns in at some point to intrinsic. So maybe the better way of saying it is your likelihood for sustained sobriety is better if you turn it to an intrinsic motivation. But to say that like you can't get sober unless you want it, how many people have been like, okay, I'm not ready yet. You know, I'm not ready yet. I'm just not ready.
Hear it all the time.
Because I don't want it. Yeah.
All the time you hear that.
Yeah.
And it's sad because we do lose a lot of people that way. Sometimes I have to take a step back. Like you're saying, you have to want it intrinsically. It can't be forced, because then you turn it into something else. You turn it into resentment. Someone forced me to get sober. And I'm sure you know that once you start building resentment, relapse is really easy to happen again. Mm. So what would you say with someone what advice would you give with someone that's on the fence of thinking of quitting whatever addiction they have? Cause there's multiple addictions out there. We know, you know, from food, sugar, porn. I mean, we could go down the whole thing, but what's your advice for someone that's on the fence, that's starting to think about it?
So if they're already on the fence, this kind of like contemplative mode, it's funny because I've asked this question to other people before and now I'm being asked it. I think if they're already on the fence, then I would encourage them about half measures, availing us nothing. I would say, I would have them reflect a future version of themselves first and say, okay, if you continue, what does it look like? And then I'd have them reflect a future version and say, like, imagine the future version of yourself is miserable sober. Which one is worse? The future version of yourself that is miserable and still in active addiction, or the version of yourself that is miserable and sober? Most people are going to be like, the one that's sober, because maybe at least I have more actions. Maybe at least maybe things aren't great, but like I'm in control. I'm not waking up shameful that I said that thing last night while I was blacked out or whatever. And I'm like, okay, so if you can conceive a future of sober being not as fantastic as somebody else's journey of sober is, it's still hard, but it's still better than what you currently got going on, then you should think about it, right? I always say you got to figure out if the juice is worth the squeeze for you. Ultimately, you really got to figure out if the juice is worth the squeeze. Like, is the effort that you're putting in to maintain a relationship with this substance, it's not a relation, it's not a human being, but it is a relationship. Is the energy that you're putting in to maintain a relationship with this substance worth the effort? And if the answer is no, if the answer is like the effort is extraneous, it's the consequences are mounting up, I can't stand all these different versions of bottoms that have come up for me, then why not try? Why not see what happens if you invest something in the opposite direction? Let's say, like, one of the things I do with my clients is, it's harder to offer this advice, but to the ether out there. But if you're my client sitting in front of me, I might say, okay, next week we're going to check in, and all I want you to do for the next week is to not use. And then if the person's active in addiction, they're going to kind of roll their eyes a little bit. Maybe they're going to be like, okay, well, I've been trying to do that, which is why I'm here now. So I'll say, right. So it's not a brilliant assignment, except here's what I want you to do. I want you to be active in journaling this experience, even just like do bullet points on your phone, just bullet point it. At 5 PM on Monday after work, I really wanted to have a drink. Tuesday comes up. At 5:30 on Tuesday after work, I really wanted to have a drink, and I had a drink. And then we're going to talk about it the next week. And then more often than not, the person probably had something to drink, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, so was the juice worth the squeeze? And we'll kind of go into that. And all that's doing is putting them into this space of from contemplation into action, right? It's putting them from this place of like, okay, I get it. I have a problem. Now I'm ready to stop having a problem because we've done the experiment. I've lost on this experiment. So let's try something in the opposite direction. And for some people, that might be going away to a program for a short period of time. For some people, it might be going away for 30 days or 28 days. Roughly for me, well, I don't even want to say that because that might mess up whoever's hearing this, but, but yeah, like, if you're on the fence, life has already given you enough experience to allow your rational mind to start to come to grips with the truth. And then I just encourage you to continue to stretch that forward. Look at that a little bit forward and a little bit forward. And you're going to have all sorts of fears that come up. You're going to think, well, my friends, my social community, well, you know, I can't even have wine. I can't even smoke a little bit of pot. What about this? What about that? And you're going to have all sorts of fears. And those are great. Process all of them. I think what the person has likely been doing up until this point has not been processing all of them. They've been avoiding processing it. And once they get to this place of processing it over and over, then all of a sudden you get to this place of like, okay, well, maybe I can even just try. Maybe I'll shoot for a month. Let me try sober October or whatever. Let me just try and see what happens, you know? And then for something, there's other people like, you know, it depends on how far you are on that fence and how far you are ready to jump off of that fence in whatever direction. Like for me, like I was at a place where I had to know, like I can never use this substance ever again. I was ready to never use this substance ever again. I just didn't know how to do it. And again, that didn't include alcohol at the time, but it just segued into alcohol around the same time. But yeah, I hope that's helpful. So essentially what I'm saying is, if you're there for a reason. Like you haven't got, like, normies don't think like this. Normies don't think, let me see if I can get away with having only this much to drink. Let me see if I can only have this much to smoke. Normal people don't think like that. 90% of the world doesn't think like that. But people who suffer with addiction, like me, think like that. We try to, despite all rationality, despite the fact that it doesn't make rational sense to maintain a relationship with a substance, we try to make excuses to maintain a relationship with a substance. And so if you're thinking like that, you already know you got some ground to cover. You already know, like, you're working from behind. And so why not try to invest in the opposite direction and then just see what happens? Because you could always go back to it. Like, it's not going anywhere, you know, like, it's just not going anywhere. It will be there for you. If you find out the sober life ain't for you, it's not going anywhere.
I think that's some excellent advice.
Yeah.
So what kind of gear are you using?
Yeah. So right now I'm using an old rucksack that's sitting right here. yeah. So that's actually a question I have for people. Like I said, I'm kind of new to this, but so I'm trying to figure out what the right shoe brand is for me. I'm still trying to figure out, you know, all that kind of stuff. I had plantar fasciitis before this whole experience, from HIIT training and stuff like that. So, I think what I'm using for long runs are, the Saucony, Speed, what is it? I think it's a Speed or Speed Pro or Pro Speed or something like that. So I'm using those on on runs, and then on rucks, I'm using the Cloud Monsters on rucks, and then on trails, I'm using the Nike. They have a weird name. It starts with an A, I think. They have a weird name, but they're like a Nike trail shoe. They got a nice little sock liner on there. So I use those on trails. I got a Spec Ops rucksack that I bought in Afghanistan 20 years ago for $40. And now they're apparently $280. So I don't know if I would buy the same brand. It's so much money. Yeah. So much money. So I got a Spec Ops ruck that I'm using. And then I'm using Salty Britches for the old, I got thick legs, short, thick legs. So the Salty Britches are very helpful in between the thighs. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're trying to, you know, grow our platform up, and who's someone that you could recommend for us to have on our podcast? You know, anyone with a good story, a mentor?
Yeah. Like, so literally everybody I've had on my podcast, I would recommend. So it's almost like, which guest would you pick? And I don't want to pick a favorite one, but, yeah. So, Lindsay Boston has probably the most incredible story I've ever heard of resiliency. Just in terms of, life happening to her in a horrific way, and her continuing to push and continuing to grow and continuing to, be somebody that does things and doesn't let doctors or medical diagnosis stop her. She was my second episode. My son, my 9-year-old, was my first episode.
Oh, that's awesome.
And yeah, it's fun to hear, a 9-year-old. He's not a normal 9-year-old. Because he's raised by me. And so to hear a 9-year-old who's raised by me talk about resiliency is pretty inspiring. And then, so second was Lindsay Boston, and Lindsay has, she was born with a bunch of different diagnoses, but she has the longest list of diagnoses I asked her to say her diagnosis and she talked for 6 minutes.
Jeez.
Yeah, it is one thing after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, after another. I'm not exaggerating. After another, after another, after another. And she was born with a whole bunch of things, but she kind of worked through it. She got into like CrossFit. She got into the ultra running. She got into jiu-jitsu. She became a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, competed at the highest level, won high level tournaments in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And then she got in a car crash and it was fuel on the fire of all these diagnoses that she had. And it was just like, she has a horrific medical story. And I met her out, on my first 100 out there with Ed Ettinghausen. She was out there with a walker, a feeding tube, and a RN walking with her the entire time.
And wow.
Incredible story. She got 50 miles in.
Wow.
And yeah. And she had to stop several times because like when she stops, she gets nauseous and like passes out. So she has just, she's an amazing human being, amazing human being. So yeah, if I had to pick one that I feel like everybody should know her story, it'd be Lindsay Boston.
That sounds like a good story.
Yeah. Well, another one would be can I suggest one more?
Yeah, go for it.
So, in my story of series, I interviewed Alex Delgado, and I can send you his information or both of their information if you want.
Okay.
But so Alex Delgado, I haven't interviewed him for the podcast yet, but I did it for the story of series on my Recovery Hill channel. And, he's got an incredible addiction story. He's also, gone through, he's done, an Ironman, I think two, maybe an Ironman and a half Ironman. I don't know. I might be messing up his credentials a little bit, but his story of addiction and recovery and getting to the point of, doing things physically challenging is pretty incredible too. It's his addiction story is mind blowing.
Does sound like great guest for us.
Yeah.
Well, Kenny, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for, being so vulnerable and telling us your story and all that fun stuff. We'll give you a few minutes to shout out whoever you want to shout out, where people can find you, podcast, social media, Strava, if you want.
Before I do that, can I ask you a question?
Go for it.
I've been asking this question to guests for the podcast, that are like suffer with mental illness or addiction. Why do you think it is endurance sports or things of that nature that attract us to it?
I love this question. I've got asked this question multiple times, and now since recovery, it's totally has a different light. I'll put it that way. Mm. Before recovery, it was just something I did, a community type of thing, learning about myself, that kind of stuff. Then after becoming sober, you know, all that shit really hit me, like having to deal with emotions that I haven't dealt with in 30 years, mm-hmm. all that stuff, mm-hmm. really learning who I am as a person is another huge one. And I mean, I learned something new about myself every single day. Sometimes, you know, multiple times throughout the day, mm-hmm. you know, so pre-sobriety, it was just something. I have a love for the mountains. I love for adventure. And I would just go out there and do it. And a lot of times I was using while I was out there, while I was doing the stuff, you know, I'd just get high.
What were you using?
I would you know, smoke cannabis or eat edibles. Mm-hmm. That was my you know, main substance of choice was cannabis. Mm-hmm. Then of course, after the event, I would sit around and drink, mm-hmm. Until, you know, I couldn't anymore, or we'd go somewhere else to continue drinking. And it was just in those times, it was the sense of being a part of something, fitting in, that kind of stuff than post sobriety. You know, there's a lot of trauma childhood that I went through that I didn't, you know, they always say you're running from something. That was always a big thing that I would get from people. Sounds like you're running from something. And I'm like, no, I just enjoy myself. Mm-hmm. Then after I got sober, you know, a lot of this childhood trauma started popping up, abandonment issues from my father, a few other things. And that's when I really had to dig deep and, you know, ask myself why I go do this stuff. And to tell you now, I was running from something. I have been, you know, since the age of 15, I was started running from something. And it's just those traumas through childhood that I didn't know how to deal with that time because I didn't really know what they were. Now that I know what they are and how to deal with them in a healthy way, it's just, it's really changed my thought process and my patterns. And, you know, I've had many, many conversations with people out on the trail, and I hear a lot of the same stories, childhood, some traumatic issue. I can't say that I've really ever met someone out on the trail that hasn't had something happen to them. Mm-hmm. While they were growing up or recently and stuff like that. And the more I kind of, you know, dug into it, I think the way for me was getting out there in nature, in the mountains, doing really hard shit, was just to numb the pain. You know, it was my addictive mind didn't want to deal with it. So anyway, I didn't have to deal with that pain. That's how I chose. So if it was a substance or being out on the trail, I could just numb that pain out. Then after I got sober, that didn't work anymore. I'd be out on the trail. I'd have anxiety attacks. Mm-hmm. All kinds of weird stuff would happen. I'd get back to my car and full-blown anxiety attack. Then, you know, I talked with some other people in recovery, and that's when I noticed I was changing one addiction from another addiction. Mm-hmm. And you probably know about this quite a bit when, you know, we give up one thing and we go hard into something else. Yeah, I've been doing this for, you know, 13, 14 years. But then all of a sudden, I was trying to replace my substance abuse with running, mm-hmm. or being outside, whatever kind of venture. And there was no intention. There was no purpose. It was to get out there and numb the pain. And that was really hard for me because this is like something I enjoy. This is what I do for fun. Go challenge myself. I've learned a lot about myself throughout the years out on the trail in the mountains. And it was like, there's a line drawn in the sand. You know, not sober Robbie to sober Robbie. And then sober Robbie was like, this isn't working. So that's a new journey I'm on, is mm-hmm. falling in love back in with the adventure, the journey, the process, but dealing it in a, you know, emotional sobriety way. Mm-hmm. And anytime anything comes up, I don't like run harder or do something to numb that pain. I'll deal with it out on the trail now or out in the mountains, whatever I'm doing. So it's a new learning process for me, and I have my days still. I know I'll continue to have them for the rest of my life. I always tell people, you know, I chose this life and it's going to be a struggle for the rest of my life with my addictions. And I'm fine with that. I'm ready for it. And I'm ready to move on and just keep on plugging away.
Can I offer you pushback? Isn't the right word. Can I offer you yes and to what you just said.
Yeah.
So the struggle for the rest, how long have you been sober, Robbie?
15 months.
15 months. Wonderful, yeah. Dude. That's great. Good job. Thank you. So the struggle from an addiction side of things isn't that hard over a prolonged period of time. Right now it is. Right now it is. Like, I think for me, I used to say in the first, it was about 3 years. I would say this, I would say at meetings or when people would ask me, I would say, you know, like if I could use without having negative consequences, I would, but I can't because it will become a thing and then I'll have negative consequences. So I just can't. So I've made peace with the fact that I can't. And I was saying that at a meeting. I was about 3 years sober. I was saying that at a meeting and like I'd, anyway, that's a whole other note, but I was at a meeting at this point and I was sharing that and I stopped myself because it felt not genuine. It felt like I was just saying it because that's what I say. It's part of my thing. And I stopped myself and I said, wait. I don't know. This feels really weird to say, but I think even if I were to have no negative consequences, I would still prefer not to use right now. And it was the first time, it took me about 3 years to where, and for me, I think that's the transition from, and this is my own language, that's the transition from sobriety to recovery is like, there's abstinence where you're just using substance, or you're just not using substances. And then there's sobriety, which is you're actively doing things to not use substances. And then there's recovery where like the idea of using again is laughable because of the life that you've built up for yourself without it. And so, but it took me roughly 3 years to get there of like running an honest program, really being like, you know, like pushing myself in different areas that was uncomfortable, mostly psychological areas, and spiritual areas, like really testing the bounds of those and pushing those and trying to become better in those. But, and it took about 3 years until that was right for me. And then somewhere around that time frame too, it was just like the feeling of struggle and association with needing to be sober instead of just being sober. Like there's a transition there. It's just, I'm just sober. Like, I don't know. I don't need to put in effort to be sober. This is just how I am. Like, this is how it is, you know. It's not a challenge to be sober anymore. And so like I hear that often where people say, you know, it's going to be a struggle, or that might even be something that keeps somebody away because they're like, it's just going to be a struggle for the rest of my life. And I think for most people that I've been around, or let me say it this way, I don't know anybody that has long-term recovery that will tell me that they're struggling with not using a substance. You know, like they'll struggle in other areas of life, right? Like, because there's all sorts of domains to continue to work on and grow on in life. You know, there's relationships. That's a never ending one to continue to grow on and work on. But, yeah, I guess that's one thing I want to encourage you with, Robbie, is, you know, if you keep running an honest program, and it sounds like you're really doing good work with like going deep and checking in on the, processing that childhood stuff and moving past it, or not moving past it, but moving through it is a better way of saying it. Just working through those things. I don't see it with your aptitude for resilience and workload and putting in the time. I don't see it being a struggle for you. Now, who knows, like if running is, you know, like if ultras or something are going to be something that you ever get back into or not, I would imagine you probably will. But yeah, like either way, like whatever the next thing is for you, if it's not like ultra marathons, again, I can see it happening at some point, but even if it wasn't, if it was something totally different, that thing is going to be life-changing for you. It's going to be incredible for you. It's going to be the thing, right? It's going to be the thing for you. And so, either way, you're on the right path. That's awesome. 15 months, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I guess, so the sobriety part that's not the struggle anymore. It's the definitely working through the traumas.
Hey, Robbie.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's kind of cutting out on my end. I can't hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, there we go.
Okay.
So on my side, the sobriety part's not the struggle anymore. It's working through the trauma and that more, the more part of the recovery part is just because I have my days, but I know it's going to happen. So, but
yeah.
All right, Kenny, we'll give you a few seconds to shout out whoever you want to, more than a few seconds, shout out whoever you want, tell people where they can find your podcast, your social media and all that.
Yeah. So let's see, social media. I got two different Instagrams. I got the Instagram that is really about just like recovery. That's mostly just for mostly just my clients go there. Like, I don't know. So that's Recovery Hill. Kenny from Recovery Hill, I think is what it is. Kenny _ from _ Recovery Hill. I believe that's what it is. And then I have the Instagram for the Patinaed Podcast, which is, I think, Patinaed Podcast. I should know this stuff, dude. Let me let me pull it up here real quick. The Instagram. So the Instagram handle for the Patinaed Podcast is Patinaed, again with a D, _ podcast. Patinaed Podcast. And then the YouTubes. There is a YouTube. The Patinaed Podcast is also on YouTube. You can just search Patinaed Podcast. It'll come up. You also search Patinaed Podcast on Spotify. That's a good thing about having a unique name. It'll come up for it. It comes up. and then Apple Podcasts, you search Patinaed Podcast. It'll come up under the search. And then for the recovery side of things, I have some good videos. Well, quality wise, maybe not that good, but content wise, good videos, information wise, good videos, for recovery and sobriety. Recovery at Recovery Hill, I believe. Let me go. I'm just double checking. That is Recovery Hill. Is it at Recovery Hill? At Recovery Hill. One word, at Recovery Hill. So that's my, that's the YouTube channel. That's where I've done some videos. If you're looking to find out about resiliency, I mean, people that listen to this podcast are probably people that are athletically have challenged themselves to be in a place of resiliency. So, but there's a video I put on there, one of the earlier videos series called Window of Tolerance. There's another video series for education wise called The Five Pillars on there. And then there's that playlist called The Story of Playlist is on the Recovery Hill YouTube channel. There's some good just sobriety recovery oriented stuff on the Recovery Hill channel.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Kenny.
Shout outs. Let me
get your shout outs in.
Shout out. my wife won't care, but my kids would like it if they heard me shout them out. So, my four boys, I'm not going to shout out their names on here maybe, but, my four boys, they know who they are. They're studs, walking, talking miracles. And, so I want to shout out my four sons and my wife. She's an amazing mother, to my boys. She's such a solid foundation for them. So yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I love it. Well, Kenny, thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation and I really enjoyed it.
I really appreciate it, Robbie. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem.